All right, I'm waving. Do you see me?
Yeah, there you go.
are you at Adobe headquarters there?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I had to come down here for some meetings.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Street PX coming back to you for episode number 40. My name is Casper, and as always, I am joined by my friend and co-host.
Jim Watkins. How you doing, Casper?
I am doing great. It is May 19, and we have a great show for you today as we welcome in Adobe's very own Josh Haftel to talk some, you know, technical talk. But before we do that, we want to throw out some photographic happenings. Last episode, we asked listeners to share with us some exhibits that are going on in their neck of the woods, and we received one here from Michael Kowalczyk. Michael is a New York City-based photographer, but recently won second place at the Urban Street Diving for his photographic series. This is taking place in Rotterdam, an exhibit there on Saturday, May 27. So this is for you international shooters out there. A big congrats to Michael for getting second place, and much thanks for letting us know about it. So go check out urbanstreetdiving.com and rawstreetphotogallery.com for more information. Jim, you noted you had an exhibit you wanted to bring up, right?
Oh, yeah. I just want to let you know, guys, know that we had a great time. The San Francisco Street Photography Group went over to see this exhibit, Dorothea Lange, The Politics of Seeing, at the Oakland Museum of California. It was fantastic. We had a great time checking it out. There's just some amazing work. Maybe there's some Dorothea Lange aficionados out there. But if you're in the Bay Area, definitely check it out. It's opened last May 13th, so last week. And it's running. I'm not sure how long it's running. I'll have to get back to you guys on that. Maybe we'll put it in the show notes. But it's a fantastic exhibit and worth seeing.
All right. Now, folks, this is the last show before our much-anticipated live studio recording at Street Photo. That's here in San Francisco. This is going to be a fantastically insane chance to come and watch us banter and bullshit with a full panel in real time. And we want you there in our peanut gallery. Tickets are still available, and best of all, they are free. This is all happening at the Harvey Milk Photo Center on June 9th. We'll be starting around 4 o'clock, so head over to streetpx.com. or streetphoto.org, and from there you can get more information and register. We definitely recommend registering. It's limited, but they're free. Now, we want to take a minute and give some love to our wonderful sponsor, Glass Key Photo in San Francisco. Gordon and Matt over there, a couple of friends of ours, are in the Lower Haight District. They have one of the most impressive film shops in the city and demands a visit. If you're looking for 35mm film, medium format, developing chemicals, darkroom paper, classic cameras, lenses, repairs, what have you, whatever you need when it comes to analog, they have you covered. So when in town, head down to 442 Haight Street and give some love from us here at Street PX. So, anyway, enough with the plugs. It's time to jump straight into our episode as we welcome in Josh Haftel from Adobe. Josh is he's one of the product managers there for Lightroom. And we got one hell of a great conversation waiting for you. A bit technical, but definitely helpful. So big, big hello out there, Josh.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Great. Welcome.
Hey. As we said, my name is Josh, and I work over here at the Adobe, but everybody else around the world, wherever I'm traveling, like, oh, you work at Adobe. I'm like, cool. Yeah, I work at Adobe. But anyway, so yes, I work at Adobe. I work on the Lightroom team. The product that I specifically focus most of my time on is on Lightroom Mobile. So the mobile products both on the iOS platform, the Android platform. We also have a version of Lightroom Mobile that works on the web as well as on Apple TV. So I kind of work with variety. I can't even speak the English today, but I work with a variety of people on different teams, and it's a lot of fun.
Excellent. We're so glad to have you in. And we know that your time's limited, and we have a ton of things to cover. So let's jump right into your photography, because you are more than just a part of that Adobe engine. You're also a very talented shooter yourself. And from looking at your work, you seem to have a big focus on travel photography, as well as something near and dear to to my heart is that your long exposure black and white work. So let's kick this off with sharing a little bit about who you are with our listeners out there.
Yeah, well, I do. I went to school for photography, and I was lucky enough to get a job in tech, which is I don't think like, especially when I came out of school, was never good enough to actually make a living as a photographer. So I was really lucky to get a job in tech, and I started working at Nick Software back in 2001, and that made it possible for me to meet a whole range of different really awesome photographers and hone my craft and go out shooting with them and learn lots of different kinds of technologies, lots of different kinds of approaches and styles. And so today, like, I would say from a photography perspective, the things that get me most excited are ways of being able to bridge communication gaps. Like, how do I help people meet and learn new cultures and new areas? So I spent 2 years traveling, backpacking as a photographer throughout Southeast Asia. It was a wonderful time in my life. I was really, really blessed to have that opportunity. And throughout that process, being able to meet up with lots of different people, lots of different cultures, lots of different areas, and be able to like try and hopefully like get people to stop thinking about places in terms of exoticism, but as actual people and actual humans and actual areas that are just really, they're interesting, they're unique, they're their own people. They're like, but I guess the way I think about it is like, we're all 99% the same. We're only 1% different from each other. And it's like that 1% different that's cool, but it's that 99% the same that I think is really amazing and helping other people that haven't had a chance to travel as much as I've been blessed to be able to travel is something that I like to do. So that's something that's really exciting to me. The other side of my photography that you mentioned is the kind of fine art photography, or I'll put the quotation mark fingers, fine art photography up. There's something that I do like about abstract or photography that is less about like a clear and obvious subject. Something about communicating like a emotion or it could be either like something that's very, very ephemeral, or it could be something where it's just like, hey, these patterns are pleasing to the eye and I really enjoy looking at them and there's something about them. Sometimes I do photography that I would imagine other photographers would be like, oh, wow. As a photographer, I also appreciate that. But then you show it to a non-photographer, they're like, what is that? Why? So people, like, I remember one of my favorite series that I did is this series of these wave breakers in Japan. They're called tetrapods, and just meaning 4 feet. And they're just these really interesting, large-scale, concrete blocks that just – they're designed to break the waves. And, you know, the jury's actually out whether or not they make the life better or not. At least in some way, they create, like, habitat of fish and whatnot because of them. But when I was traveling around in, like, some of the parts of Japan, down this one island called Amakusa, which is off of Kyushu, it's basically really far away from a lot of things. And the only reason I went there is I had a friend who grew up there. And so we were traveling Japan. She was like, hey, let's go stay with my grandma. So we went all the way. Took like 2 days to get there. But while walking around there and hanging out, like, I just saw these really, really big tetrapods, and to picture them, they kind of look like a jack.
That's what I thought when I saw them. Yeah.
Yeah. So they look like jacks, right? But they're humongous. Like, they're enormous. They're really, really big. They're probably about like different sizes of them, but 12 to 20 feet tall, each one of these things. And it's just hard to imagine like what they're for. And then what was really neat about them while I was walking around is like seeing that some fishermen had built these little walkways on these tetrapods as a way of going down to the ocean, like, because you would be on these like piers, and then they would have these tetrapods. And so to be able to like get to a point where they could like cast their lines, they would build up all of these, like, they would take pallets and they would like drill into the tetrapods, and they spent a lot of time. But the first time I saw it, there was some kind of like otherworldliness to them of like, oh, I wonder who's doing this and why are they doing this and where do these things go? And it almost reminded me of if you guys saw like the OA, there's like parts of the OA where like they're going into these other worlds and like entering through these, like, I don't know. It's just, I'm a big sci-fi nerd, and like my mind is always going off in weird places. And I saw, like, on one side, I saw these tetrapods with these like planks, and I was imagining that there was some kind of like alien race that was like had built up these things, and like it was just, I don't know, it was really fun anyway. So I wanted to take pictures of it because, one, it was like these really interesting shapes that I had never seen before, and I could create like a very visual, graphic, kind of design-like thing. And then on the other side, it kind of, it sparked my creative mind and like got my thinking like, oh, it's over there. And then, you know, so I spent a little bit of time to like take a lot of these photos. Anyway, long story short, I showed these pictures that I was really excited about to some friends. They were like, what is that? And why did you take that picture? And I was like, you don't get it. and so that's a lot of fun. So like there's the two sides of me. I would say if I would like just to summarize it, there's like the one side, which is I try and be very graphical, very like I love lines and shapes. I operate by the rule of halves instead of the rule of thirds. You know, like I like to put everything smack dab in the center of my photos. I like to have intersecting lines. I spend a lot of time like lining things up, and that's kind of like the visual graphic side of me. And then the other side is like people, especially kids. I get along really well with kids, mostly because I'm a big, goofy, multicolored hair individual that like kids seem to get attracted to a lot. And I have lots of unicorn possessions. And like some people call me a brony, even though I'm not, but whatever. Like I'll go with it. It's cool. And like you just have fun with kids. And so when I was going out through Southeast Asia, I would just have like – I would basically be at the bottom of a dog pile of kids at any one day. Any day. You just – pick a day, there was a pile of kids on top of me playing, and we were just like having fun and getting to know each other. And I was taking pictures of them and just like engaging with them. And just like, I don't know, a lot of the photos that I have, especially from Myanmar, just like having these really, really awesome kids that were just hanging out and being fun and just being kids. And they loved to have their photo taken. There was just something really fun about that I loved. And so I, to this day, still love taking pictures of people, which was actually weird for me because as a younger photographer, I always stayed away from pictures of people. But yeah, so that's kind of like the two sides of things that I love.
Oh, yeah, right on. Yeah, kids are a great subject for the camera, a tricky one. But, you know, there's that sense of fearlessness in their faces that we all tend to lose as we get older.
Yeah. Oh, there's something fun about, like, especially when you go outside of the States, a lot of kids aren't as inundated with photos of themselves. One of the things that I found to be really, really awesome about traveling through Southeast Asia is I would bring with me a little Fuji Instax SP1.
Oh, yeah, great camera.
No, it's a printer.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I was thinking of the Instax camera, not the printer, which is also awesome.
Yeah, I love the Instax, but like the actual printer. So I could shoot with either my X-T1 or my Leica Q or even my phone, and I could then print it directly and actually after editing it. Mm. Because, of course, I like to edit photos. That's part of the reason why I work at Adobe. And so, like, I would edit the photos, you know, in there, and then just be able to, like, print it out for them and then give the kids the picture. And they were just like, what? And they had their own picture, and they give it to their mom and their grandma. And pretty soon I'd have, like, again, another dog pile of kids wanting the picture taken, and they want their own prints going. And I would just, like, I would dedicate, like, half of my suitcase just to bring, like, these little Instax print packages with me because it was just the best thing ever. People would love it. They would just be so excited about it. You get really awesome photos. Like, everything about it was just amazing.
Yeah, interesting. Hey, now, Josh, let me ask you something. I want to step back and talk about something that you mentioned earlier, where you said 1% of what the people are exotic, and 99% we're all the same. Which I think is because I've traveled a little bit and I found that the same way. How did you try to capture that sameness? How did you try to bridge that gap with your photography?
Well, you know, I actually just think that the sameness just is, I guess, it's about the interaction and engagement with people, realizing that people mm-hmm. all care about the same stuff. Like, you know, you go and hang out with some grandma. Well, of course, the thing that she's most interested in is her grandkids. And you're like talking to her about her grandkids or whatever language you can do. Usually for me, it's sign language because I don't speak any one of the bajillion languages that are existing in the world today. So figuring out how to connect with people is always by leveraging the fact that we're all caring about the same stuff and make sure that we all focus on like the fact that kids like to play, and then just being able to figure out like, well, you know, these kids are going to play the exact same way that any other kid is going to play. There's nothing unique about this. That was the thing that, I mean, I'm lucky enough that I grew up overseas. My father was a diplomat. So it's not necessarily news to me that everybody around the world is the same, but a lot of times people focus too much on the exotics. I remember I went to high school in Israel, and people, whenever I come back to the States, people are like, oh, how do you get to school? Do you take a camel? And they weren't kidding. They literally thought that I would take like a camel to school. No, it's like I walked or I took my bike or there was a bus or we had a car. Like it's the same. It's like, It's literally the same. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. But that's the thing is, like, we get so fixated on the fact that, oh, it's got to be different. It's got to be something else that's going on over there. And so, like, it's that tendency. I think it's just human nature. It's like the – I think there's a technical term for it. I forget the name for it, but whatever. Like, the outside or out group phenomenon. Like, if anybody is a little bit different than you, you accentuate those differences and fixate on them. And – It's interesting that through the getting to know individuals, getting to know who they are and what motivates them, that has the biggest tendency to address that. And I think that that's part of the thing that we all need today as people, is we just need to recognize that there's more similarities than differences. And we're all motivated by the same things. We're all motivated by being loved and loving and just focusing on that. And of course, I'm from San Francisco, so of course I'm going to be using my own hippie butt to talk about that kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you're very right. It's a preconception many have, especially here in America. It's a misconception on what a place is really, really like. I mean, I got to admit, I grew up in a farm town. So I was a perfect example of that unintentional isolationist type of upbringing. And through that, you can develop a misconception that areas like Israel or places like Tehran, where it's urban, it's sprawled, and on par in many ways is something like New York City, you have a preconceived notion of what it is that's wholly different.
Well, we don't even have to go that far away to realize the same stuff. When I moved out to California, I had never been to California before, and I had just happened to get – I went to school in upstate New York. And I just happened to get an internship at this one company in San Diego, and I had never heard anything. Like, I didn't even know where San Diego was. I couldn't even put it on a map. I heard California. I'm like, bing, I want to go to California. And so I packed all this stuff in my car, and I drove out, and I stopped off in Las Vegas on the way out here to San Diego, and then drove from Las Vegas to San Diego, and arrived at, like, it was in the middle of June. And I had stopped driving from Las Vegas, and I was like, I was on this road that just ended at a beach, and I was like, it's June, beach, it's California, I'm going, let's go to the beach, I'm in California. And I ran out to the beach, and I ran right back around again, went back to my car to get a sweatshirt. I was like, what the heck?
The beach is your issue.
Exactly. So like the whole thing about, like, I had in my mind Baywatch, right? It was the same thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I didn't know it was going to be cold. It was like, and this is in San Diego. It was like June. But now, since I lived in San Diego for 13 years, I learned about June gloom, and I learned about, like, the hot month of September. I learned a lot of stuff, but, like, you never think about that. Like, David Hasselhoff never told me that, okay?
Yeah.
I blame David Hasselhoff.
Oh, damn you, Hasselhoff. Well, just to quickly pump the brakes, let's roll back real quick. You made a couple of points that hit me. First, you said you did a 2-year backpacking trip. That always fascinates me and makes me a bit envious, because I want to go down that road with you. What locations did you visit?
I just spent all the time basically Southeast Asia. I spent some time in East Asia, but mostly I kept on getting, I'm big into food, especially food that's, like, I think that my tongue is retarded. So, like, it needs a lot of flavor in order for it to recognize anything. And so I wanted to get a lot of Thailand and Malaysia, just kept on bringing me back over and over and over again. So, and then just getting to know the people out there. I also, because I had 2 years to just, I didn't know I had 2 years, but I had a lot of time. I knew that. And I just wanted to, like, take it slow instead of doing the normal travel of, like, okay, on day one, I'm going to be here, on day two, I'm going to be there, on day three, I'm going to be there. I wanted to, like, get past the veneer of the location. So just trying to spend as much time as possible. I meant to say as little time in transportation and as much time in one place as possible. So I spent time in all over Southeast Asia, and then also spent time in, like Hong Kong and Taiwan and New Zealand.
Oh, no, that's curious. Now, being there for so long, or outside of the Western states here, did you find that the way that you interact with the world, or maybe how you see the world, began to change or evolve in that time?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I mean, before that, I was working at Google and working really hard and making a good salary and all that kind of stuff, and getting really fixated on that component of life. And then I spent almost 2 months in Myanmar. And I found the people in Myanmar to be like some of the most beautiful people I've ever met in my life. I love the people out there. As we talked about, I love the kids out there. They were just super fun, super playful. You know, having these experiences where I'd have like monks like sitting on the back of my moped and we'd be scooting around trying to like, they'd be like, hey dude, I want to go watch some soccer. Can you like take me over to the cafe? You know, like those kinds of interactions that you wouldn't have expected to have otherwise. And like realizing that here's this group of individuals who are so happy, so like blessed with their life and really enjoying themselves, and they got nothing. And I was sitting there like before this, like I was depressed and I was like, I had all this money and I had no happiness. And here's all these people with all this happiness and almost no money. And so the realization was certainly that that happiness is on one side, it's a state of mind, that there is an intentionality behind it. Like you can decide if you want to be happy or not. And then there's also like, you can't fix that just with things, and you can't fix that with money. And so there was a great perspective that provided, that you just go out and just see these individuals. And the other thing was that family is super important. You know, a lot of the, when I started seeing the commonality, it was like these individuals, a lot of them got their satisfaction and happiness from having a strong family unit and being together with their family. And that was also something that, as somebody who comes from a very small family, I don't have any brothers or sisters, which is usually obvious after you talk to me for more than 2 minutes. and I don't have like a very large extended family. It's something where it was interesting to see that, like, made me realize that would be something that would be really interesting as well to focus on. Somehow it's hard to create uncles and aunts and cousins.
yeah, I mean, aunts and uncles come in different forms these days, not always blood.
Yeah, that's true.
Josh, I don't mean to harp on this particular issue, but I guess I'm obsessed with this 99% sure. thing. And I think, now that I'm thinking about it, I think a lot of us, as you know, some of us as photographers tend to perpetuate that notion that this 1% is so important, because I know when I was traveling, I would go out, I would always focus on what was different, mm-hmm. because I thought that would be the most interesting thing that people back home would like. Yeah. You know, they would want to see what's different, and not focusing on, you know, what, you know, how common we are. And I, you know, and like you, I saw that, you know, people are all the same, but my camera was focused on the what was different, because like I said, that was exotic. Yep. That's what people would want to see. Yep. That's what I thought.
There's this one photographer. I don't know why I'm blanking on his name. He did the series called Before They're Gone. And it was really like, it became a little bit of a stir. Because when he produced this, you know, it was 100% about the exoticism of different groups. You know, the premise of the book was, here's a group of individuals who were, we want to capture their essence before everybody becomes the same. There is this mm-hmm. grand trend towards production. If you go into Southeast Asia, everybody's wearing the same shirts. There are all these like super cheap shirts coming out of, or clothing coming out of China. And so like traditional dress is going away and being replaced by like everybody wearing a Donald Duck t-shirt or a Bugs Bunny t-shirt or whatever kind of Despicable Me was everywhere. You know, you just see the number of kids I saw wearing like Gangnam style t-shirts when I was out there was unbelievable, right? And you're like, how do you even know Gangnam style? But okay, cool, you know. But anyway, I think, and so like this book, you know, Before They Pass, was all about figuring out like, how do we like identify these groups or these tribes or these people that before their way of life is gone. And so that was like the premise of the top side of it, or what it was being presented as. And then like afterwards, it started a conversation, because it came out that, oh, well, that one Maori chief or whatever, I don't know what the head of the Maori tribe would be, but he was actually just a mayor in some town in New Zealand, and normally he goes to work every day wearing a suit and tie, but here is this picture of him like all glammed up in like traditional attire. There was something about like, you know, just the fetishization of the exotic in some ways. And it started an interesting conversation I saw between a lot of photographers about, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I mean, is this something where you're just saying like, this person isn't actually that, you're just putting them in a costume and like making this seem like this really big deal. And it is that aspect of like, are we fetishizing or are we celebrating? are we recording or are we like creating something that doesn't actually exist? Or are we like, like taking the saturation knob and turning it up in some ways? And as your point is, like, you're going out and you're traveling, you're like, I found myself the same way. It's like, oh man, everybody's wearing the same clothes. I don't want to take pictures of these folks that are wearing the same clothes. But then you start realizing, like, actually, that is a story. Because, like, when you think about it, like, everybody's going out there looking for the people in the traditional dress. I mean, one of the things that I hate most about travel photography are people that go out to these places and they pay somebody to put on a costume and pretend to be something else. And I see this all the time, and it drives me bonkers, especially in Myanmar, especially in Bagan. There's a bunch of these kids out there, and I don't fault the kids, right? And maybe I don't even fault the photographers because they get what they want. Everybody's happy, right? But at the same time, it's like they take these kids who are not Buddhist monks, and they put them in Buddhist monk clothing, and they put them into a cave, and they put a candle in their hands, and they have the kid like look like they're praying. And that kid is just doing it for some bucks, and that's cool. Again, I'm not making any kind of judgments, but like that is a photograph. That's just it's really boring photograph. I mean, let's just face it. Like that is just like trite and trivial kind of bull. I can't even say the word I was going to say, but I don't like it.
Yes, you can.
But you know, like I don't personally like that. Like I would much rather see like that kid as they are normally. Like, are we documenting or are we like creating some other kind of thing? And you know, sorry, I'm eating my beard here. It happens all the time. But you know, it also comes into the conversation, and I always think it's interesting. I went to school, as I said, for photography, and I studied fine art. I had some friends that were studying photojournalism. And we would always get into debates about, like, is it okay to change things? Is it okay to modify the scene or to edit the scene? And, of course, when I was going to school, this was before, like, there was – I mean, Photoshop was a thing, obviously. But it wasn't as often used. We're still shooting a lot of film. The color of my hair is to hide the grays. But it was all film, and so we were shooting a lot of stuff. And there were still things you could do, and you could scan it, and you could put it in Photoshop. But there was always this conversation about, like, can you modify, can you change, can you opt, like the photojournalists, of course, would be like, no, you got to record it as it was. And then people on my side, like, I'm on the fine art side, I'm like, no, I'm telling a story the way I want to tell it. And so, like, when I'm going through this whole process, I mean, we know Steve McCurry, right? He went through this process of, like, is he a photojournalist? Is he a storyteller? Which one is he doing? Same thing like the guy that did the Before Dada. The Pass. What's that?
No, I was just saying you have now Dada. That's it's factoring into this debate.
Yeah. And so like from my perspective, like I am personally a big fan of telling a story. Right? And I want to tell the story as I perceived it. I don't want to tell the story that you want to see. I want to tell the story that I perceive. And I think that's where, like, I feel like it's important for us to have some level of credibility as artists, as storytellers, to say, here is this thing. And whether it's a fantastical vision that I had in my mind, or it was something that I perceived, or like, you know what, all the ingredients were there, but they just didn't happen at the point where I pressed the button. Like, those things are all, like, very valid to me. It's just when I try and create things because I think that it's going to get me more likes, or I think when it creates, that's like, it's boring. Like, that's.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
that's not like a very, I don't know, wholesome approach to photography, in my personal opinion.
I think a lot of people share that opinion. Yeah. Oh,
but I mean, and so to also be fair, the individuals that are just starting out, like, I think I get it. Like, when you start out and you start getting some photos and you start, like, getting some people to engage with your photography, and it's the first time that you get people saying, wow, this is really amazing, that's a rush. It's like, it's a bit of a chasing the dragon, right? That first time you get that photo out there and people are like, wow! And you're like, yeah! And you're just really excited about it. You want to get that feeling again. And I totally, totally get it. And it's an easy temptation to fall into and be like, all right, I know what I can do. Like, I'm going to get this person. I'm going to put him in a monk's robe. And I'm going to get him sitting in front of the Buddha statue like this, praying. And it makes me vomit my mouth a little bit every time I see those photos. But it's cool.
Yeah, they're cool. But, you know, you're chasing that next shot of dopamine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's just the way likes are. Oh, sorry to jump in, but I wanted to take a quick moment and give some love to our awesome sponsor over at Glass Key Photo, your one-stop shop for everything analog film. Need a new camera, repairs, developing, printing supplies? You need some film, maybe 35 millimeter or medium format? They got new and they got expired. That's the place to go. They're over in the Lower Haight area, 442 Haight Street. Additionally, they have a fantastic San Francisco instant photo walk here in town. That's at 12 o'clock on the last Sunday of every month. Fuji Instax shooters, I'm looking at you. And just like any photo walk, it's not just about the pictures. It's about expanding that network and, you know, meeting other great photographers who share a love for, you know, that shooting print style. You can learn more about it by searching San Francisco Instant Photo Walk on Facebook or head over to our show notes and click the link. So if you're in the Bay Area, we definitely recommend stopping by and tell Gordon and Matt hello from all of us here at Street PX. Now, talking about contrived imagery and so forth, I think whenever you travel, that ends up happening more often to us than we'd like to admit, especially, you know, like the young men you were just describing in that cave. A lot of people are chasing the dollar, you know, and using tourists as marks to do so. So, I mean, as photographers, it's good. It's a good tip to know the area, you know, research, talk to people that you may know that live there or have been there. Just get the behind the scenes information on what to seek and, you know, what to avoid.
It's another example is Kyoto. So I was just in Kyoto a couple of weeks ago, and I love Kyoto. It's one of my favorite cities in Japan. I love Japan. I go to Japan as often as I can. Because I think that it's just one of those places where it's everywhere you turn, it's just beautiful. And Kyoto is one of those places also. Very, very beautiful place. And there's that one place called the Gion District in Kyoto, which is known as like the last home of the geisha. And people go there. A lot of people, like every corner, you see like how to dress up like a geisha. And you see all these women walking around dressed up like geisha. And no matter what I do, like even with people that I thought should know better, I see on Facebook, they're posting like, oh my God, I saw a geisha today. It's like, no, no, you didn't. I'm sorry to break it to you. That was not a geisha. Like the likelihood of you seeing an actual geisha left is very, very low. The likelihood of you seeing anybody wearing a geisha outfit, very high. Like, and that's cool. Like again, but just like, make sure that you know what's going on. And this is one of those things about like knowing your place. Just like when it comes to travel photography for me, just like I feel like I should know my equipment, I should know my gear, I should know the culture, I should know the place, I should know the people as much as I can. And if I can't know it, let's talk about it. Let's learn from people. Let's be open-minded and not just go in there like, all right, I know what's going on. I saw Memoirs of a Geisha. I know what's like.
Oh, that is so true. That is so true.
Now let's talk about post-processing. You are with Adobe, and you like processing images. What I'm curious of, do you find that being in the belly of the beast with like Nick and Google and Adobe now, that you focus on post-processing more often than you may have used to, or quite the opposite in that you see so much occurring that you find yourself moving away from it?
Well, I would say like it all stems from my beginnings as a photographer. I was never, especially in school, I think I've gotten a lot better, but I want to try and be realistic. And like, I'm not an amazing photographer. I think I'm a decent photographer, but I don't think that I'm like changing any kind of like photographic qualities or norms out there. But I like my photography. But one of the things that I've noticed over the years, though, is like the thing that I've been good at, the thing that I am better than others at, was at least in the darkroom days, is printing. I could print really, really well. And people would come to me to have me print their work for them because I was really good at it. I could get like really good quality. I was really good at dodging and burning. Like, so it was actually something where back in the darkroom days, that was the thing that I was really good at. And I was really consistent at it. And it was just a thing that I don't know if it was just like my attention to detail or like some kind of certain aspect of my personality, but that's just one of those places where I was good at. And I think that that's kind of carried over in the years, like where I would have, I remember back in school days, like I might not have had the best photo conceptually, but because it was presented really well, it was perceived very well. And right. So that was amazing. Like I just got this realization that, when it was my own version of, if you can't make it good, make it big. And if it if it's still not good, make it red. That was my own version of that.
Create that top image. Might not have content, but damn, it looks good.
Exactly. Exactly. My mats, my window mats were unparalleled. I had no cross-hatching. It was perfect. Like, there was no, like, little snakies on it. It was amazing. Like, it's a... It was really amazing to see like how the presentation of it would have a big impact. And so I think that kind of carried over into the post-processing days where I have been able to manage. Like, I started off with Photoshop in 1993.
That's when Layers was introduced.
Exactly, yeah. And so what was amazing was like that was when I was in high school, and the teacher – basically she, the yearbook advisor, she, for whatever reason, like, I God bless her, because of her, I'm where I am today. She decided that she didn't want to do the typical layout approach of like, you take the pictures, you stick it on a piece of paper, you send it out to a company. She's like, let's scan this. And so like, it was myself. I had Photoshop and a scanner and an Apple IIe. And I had this one other guy who had Cork, and the two of us, We laid out the entire, like, I scanned every photo. I was also a yearbook photographer, but I scanned every photo and I would retouch everything. And so this is like, that was my cutting my teeth on Photoshop way back in the day, like scanning everything in. And the end result was like learning the ins and outs of like taking that same perspective I had with regards to, you know, making sure that they had good contrast range and making sure the tonality was right and making sure that you could draw the eye. And I had almost an instinctive knowledge of like what's the right approach to photo editing, and it wasn't until much later on in my professional career where people started to actually lay it out and make it like put like logical, objective, explicit words to that thing that I just kind of happened to understand. Like, people's eyes would go to the brightest object in the image, so put the subject in the center or brightest object and make sure that the subject is sharp and contrasty and bright, and you're going to bring it and make sure that there's no other distractions. Like, those kinds of things that I kind of instinctively knew, like, I was able to put that to effect using Photoshop, which is really cool. Anyway.
Yeah, I still remember when that era had started, when Photoshop introduced Layers, and it was like sorcery. Yep. As far as the hard copy storyboard form of graphic design, I also remember laying that shit out, pasting, jotting down notes, and to be honest, praying at the end before going off to press. I was so happy when all that had came around. So being said, we've come a long way since 93 to what Photoshop has become. And I know a lot of listeners out there either use Lightroom or hopefully will be soon, because I teach Lightroom. So I wanted to kind of start inching us toward that conversation.
Sure.
Now Adobe Photoshop is great, but Lightroom is more, at least in my opinion, a photographer-centric piece of software. Photoshop seems to have become so robust with so many tools that it's almost an overwhelming application. I mean, unless you have specific needs, of course.
Oh, I think even then it's overwhelming.
Yeah. I mean, with 3D, animation, video, all these baked in new tools, and I'm like, these are awesome, but I don't really need 99% of that.
Yep. Well, and that's where Lightroom was invented to begin with. I mean, it was focused on like what, well, so one of the things I thought was really fun was Adobe focused on, like, we had a product called Photoshop for, was it 26 years, 27 years now? I can't remember exactly how old it is, but it's over 25 years, right? And so like Lightroom, Photoshop has been out for a long time and has the word photo in there. But like, as you said, there was a lot of things that weren't photo related. A lot of the image processing that was built into it wasn't necessarily photo related. It was like, hey, these are pixels. And there's a reality between how pixels in a photograph work versus pixels in a design or pixels in a web page or pixels in a 3D or pixels in a video. Like, they're not all the same. And by creating this product like Photoshop, you create this amazing tool, an amazing like set of features and tools that can do anything. It's like, you know, it's breaking it down to its absolute barest components. And it's really amazing what you put it in the hands of somebody who's really amazing at it, and you can do so much. At the same time, it also requires a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of learning, a lot of skill, a lot of all these other things. And so Lightroom was really conceptualized as hey, let's make something that's focused on a couple of things that are unique to photos, which is, one, photos have a certain characteristic to the way that the pixels and the light and the detail and all that stuff is comprised. And so we can put some like barriers or limits on the tool set that you'd use to say, hey, look, these are the tools that work really well for photos. these tools that don't work well for photos, well, let's just ignore them. So that way you don't have to worry about learning something you don't need to use. And two, like, what's another thing that's really unique about photos, which is that photography, a lot of times people, especially in the digital age, shoot more than one image. Mm-hmm. And with that more than one photo, you need to have some workflow component to it. Yeah. Like, how do we make this thing more effective, more efficient? So that's something that I think is also really an integral, important part of Lightroom, is the fact that it is designed around the concept of it being for more than one photo. And then the third thing that Lightroom has been built around and enabling is managing your library. And I got at home 12 terabytes of photos that are all managed by one Lightroom catalog. And it's just really, really great that I could at any point, you know, use like a
one Lightroom catalog.
Yeah, it's huge. but yeah, I could get all this stuff together and I can be able to organize it, and I can find photos from any point in my photographic career, even photos that I started shooting back when, like, I first got my I'm trying to remember what the first digital camera that I was really using. It was an Olympus something, and it wasn't even mine. I just borrowed it from like my school when I was still working over there. They had a couple of digital cameras at the time. But anyway, the point is, like, I can go back to those photos. I can find them. I can re-edit them. I can, like, have a little laugh about, like, oh, I thought that was good editing. Oh, it's so cute.
Oh, boy.
But finding them is key, though. When I first jumped into Lightroom, when it first came out, that was the most holy shit moment ever. Instead of tracking down folders, file names, and trying to figure out what I called it, the keywording, or the keywording in particular, was a saving grace across my entire archive. I can't tell you how many jobs I had to eventually say no to because I couldn't find the original image to print or send. Now with Lightroom, you know, the client shows up, they like the picture, they want it for commercial use, for instance. I just type in a subject as related to the picture, as long as I set it, of course, and boom, rinse, repeat.
Yeah. So it is a device or a product that was designed to try and solve or make a person's life better in the photography world. And so, you know, your point of Photoshop v. Lightroom, there's this idea that Lightroom has had in the beginning, Lightroom 1.0, there was a lot of things missing in there that people needed to use. And so Photoshop was a necessity. I mean, it was something where if I looked at my own personal workflow, I would say that 50% of the images that I did any kind of retouching on had to go into Photoshop in order to finish them up in Lightroom 1. And over the years, that percentage has gone down considerably, especially as new features have been added in. So, like, the most recent one that to me has, like, knocked that percentage down a considerable amount, again, has been the guided upright. Because, again, if I look at the kind of photography that I like to do, especially when I'm doing man-made objects, which is where there's a lot of, like, lines in there. And to me, like, I did take a bunch of architecture classes, and I remember my architecture photography professor, he was ruthless in that if you had any lines that didn't align, he would just take your photo, put like a grid on top of it, and any lines in a line, start knocking off grades for every single line that just kind of like converged. Oh, yeah. And so, like, that's stuck in my head to some degree. Like, oh, my lines better be like perfect. And then the guided upright has been amazing for that. I can be sloppy as all get out, right? Don't worry about it. That's good later. So, like, I would do that stuff inside of Photoshop before. No, of course, there's still some things that I can't do not in Photoshop. You know, getting back to the topic we were talking about earlier, which was like capturing a scene that maybe didn't actually exist, but is what you perceived. There's a couple of my photos, like some of my favorite photos that I did, where, you know what? I don't care. I'm not a photojournalist. I move things around, and I'm going to like do some kind of manipulation. There was this one photo, for example, of these two. I was in Myanmar. I was hiking and trekking around, and there was these. I woke up early. And was out with my camera, and I heard a little rustling behind me, and I turned around, and like these two monk novices on homemade stilts came out of like the bamboo.
I saw that picture.
Yeah, they were coming out.
I saw that picture.
And it was just like this amazing, like, oh my God. And I was like, ah, you know, and I turned around, and I was like, I gotta take this picture. This is amazing. And I fired off a bunch of shots. And of course, like one shot, like one kid was in focus, another shot, the other kid was in focus. I'm like, I don't give a shit. Like, this is for me. This is my photo that I'm going to, like, that's what happened. I didn't like these kids were there. They came out of that like area just exactly like that. But one of them was just, you know what? Maybe if I were a better photographer, I would have gotten it, but I'm not going to let that like hold me back from capturing and presenting the thing that I actually saw that was actually there. Deposited those two kids together. It wasn't the two kids together. Like I said, like they were both there. I just composited one shot where the kid was in focus and the other shot where the other kid was in focus to actually convey that experience. And like I did that in Photoshop, and there was no shame to me about doing that. I think that was a representation of something that actually happened, but doing it in a way that I can overcome a technical limitation, either my own technical limitation or my camera's technical limitation. And that's part of like the some of the reasons why I might go into Photoshop still today is like I have these tools at my disposal, right? So I think about like I usually use cooking analogies. Like I like MSG. I'm going to put MSG in my food. It's the same thing. Like Photoshop sometimes it's the MSG.
Yep. Give a little injection. And look, like you said, you're not a photojournalist. You're not creating a documentary. You're trying to create a scene that you saw in your head. And you're an artist in the end. I think
that's the key right there. You're an artist. You know, and you're it's your own perception. That's very important. Not a photojournalist.
And now a lot of these tools you can find in your mobile phone, actually, especially with software like Lightroom Mobile becoming more and more powerful with each update. I think the last one was the addition of RAW, I think DNG, and the ability to automatically do HDR for those of you out there that enjoy that kind of thing. But all these things are happening now to bridge the gap between your home system and your pocket.
Yep. And that's the goal. Like my entire intention as it relates to Lightroom Mobile is to say, I'm reaching over my phone. I got this amazing computer in my pocket at all times. And this amazing computer has an amazing camera in it. And what I can do now is I can either use my amazing computer as why do I have to wait until I get home to my laptop? Right. I want to do my work. Sometimes I think about it like the ways the Greeks did, right? They got the muses, and sometimes the muses speak to you, and they hit you over the head with like, oh, why don't you do this thing? And I might be at a cafe somewhere. I might be on a bus. I might be like, who knows? I might be on the John. I don't know where it is or like the thing happens.
Sometimes the best ideas come from the John.
Exactly, right? And now that these things are waterproof, it can even happen in the shower, right? And so
Yeah.
And so, like, why are we going to hold ourselves back, right? And so, like, the goal is to be able to say, I want to take that idea that I have, and I want to take it to its logical conclusion. Because the reality is, and this is, I think, the truth for most people today, we ask of ourselves to do more and more with less and less time. And so that means, like, we're always – and it might just be a function of the fact that we can. And maybe I don't need to go out there and see that one band, or maybe I don't need to go out and attend that one art gallery opening, but because I can, and it's right there, you know, now I have less time to be at home doing the stuff that I'm doing. So like having the opportunity when I'm available, when I can be able to go out there, that to me is really exciting. And so like having these needs, whether it's, I need to do selective adjustments, I need to do more enhancements, I need to be able to go one step further with my editing tools, whatever those might be. I don't want to say, oh, I got to wait until I go home. Right. And I don't like compromising. This is that only child in me. Like I want what I want when I want it, and I want it right now.
I mean, all these other factors are just obstacles you have to get over, things that hinder our creativity, battling our tools and so forth. When you have these holy shit moments, it's usually at inopportune times, be it on the John, in the shower, on the transit. And whenever you tell yourself that you can wait till later, you know, for when you get home, well, then later never comes. That idea just fades from the memory.
Yeah, that's right.
The way I think about it is like we're just always, our attention is just subdivided by so many different things. Like if I don't do the thing when it comes to mind, it will never happen. Right. And so that's part of the thing to me is like I don't want there to be any compromises. There's getting to be fewer and fewer reasons why. Now, we are constantly looking at new technologies and constantly looking at how do we push the barrier, push the envelope. So as an example, we talked about that HDR. And so that HDR that we put into here is a great example of pushing the envelope a little bit, because if you go out there and you look at any of the HDR technologies built into these cameras, like so the Apple iPhone and the Android, or even like the Samsung S8 or the LG or the Huawei or the HTC or the blah, 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 all these different manufacturers, they all have really great HDRs inside of their devices also. But they have to make a number of compromises in the technology and the capabilities because what they're trying to do is they're trying to make it real time. They know that their target audience is a consumer that might not necessarily have the desire or even the willingness to understand why it's not instantaneous. Whereas for us, we're like, you know what? You still have that. We're not going to take that away from you. You can still fire up your Google Pixel and shoot the HDR in there, fire up your iPhone, shoot the HDR in there. But if you have the desire to go farther, we can do that. And you can open it up in here and we can shoot off, like you said, 3 shots. It can automatically merge them together, but it's going to take some time and it's not going to be instantaneous. And it might make your phone a little bit warm and it might use up a little bit of batteries.
And it usually does.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the point is like saying, why should you, if that's important to you, why not have that option? Like, it doesn't mean you always have to use it. Like, it's, there is important thing. It's still like, we're not trying to tell you go out there, spray and pray and just, no. You know, like, know your device, know when you should use it, know when you shouldn't use it, no different than when you get your camera, and realize like, all right, you know what? These scenarios would be really better in HDR and I can actually capture something that I might not have been able to capture otherwise. And I appreciate the fact that the end result is a DNG and I can change, I don't have to have a compressed JPEG where all the processing is like built in and baked in. So these things are all important, and so it's a compromise. And we're willing to provide that option as a compromise to say, if you want fast and immediate and small file sizes, well, go ahead and shoot the JPEG built into your camera. If you want higher quality with more control, here's an option for you. And we're not making any kind of judgments. We're not saying like one is better than the other. We're just saying that sometimes you need one, sometimes you need the other. If you look at my camera roll on my phone, you'll see lots and lots of crappy photos. And that's not because like, I'm going to hold myself to, I'm going to take a picture of me being silly out there, like having fun with some friends at a bar, or like taking a picture of like my shoes to let myself know, like, or send it to my girlfriend, like, do these shoes look good on me? You know, like all those kind of things. That doesn't mean that I'm not a photographer. Like that's right. There's different things for different purposes. Right. And there's different purposes and different uses of it. And so we shouldn't hold ourselves to some kind of unrealistic expectations. And the result, I think, is that we can see inside of our cameras and inside of our phones, we have these processors. We can do more and more with them. And so what can we do? What can we maximize? And every year they're getting better. And every year they're getting stronger. And every year we can start saying, oh, okay, well, we haven't done feature X before because it's been too time consuming or it just wouldn't work or it would just cause the phone to crash. But maybe we look at it today and be like, oh, wow. Now, actually, we should reassess that and say, oh, we could actually do that. And so we're right now developing a bunch of new features that we didn't do before because there have been limitations. And those limitations have either gotten to the point where, like, you know what, it's fine. We can live with those limitations, or they're completely gone now because the processing and the CPU and GPU and memory and all that other stuff have gotten so great. And you're like, well, there's no reason not to at this point.
Well, speaking of software and new features, you specifically work with the Lightroom mobile division, right?
Yeah, well, yes, but also with other teams. I mean, Adobe is, we call it a matrix organization, which means that we all work together in a fairly kumbaya approach to work. So we all get into each other's business all the time.
On the backs of a lot of these new features, you know, such as the HDR for mobile or the freakishly amazing dehaze filter that came out last year for CC. Are there any features coming down the pipeline that you want to share? Maybe raise a little buzz for our listeners out there?
The problem that I have is I'll get into trouble with my handlers.
Oh, you saw right through
before.
Me trying to bleed some information out of you. Yeah.
No. The problem also is like what I've seen that happens from time to time is like everything works fine until you reach that one problem that's like, now we can't do it anymore. And I don't like getting excited about something and have it yanked out of the way. So we've got to be a little bit conservative, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of things look good on a whiteboard before you try to implement it.
Yeah. Well, we've gotten to the point now where we've built a bunch of things and like, it's, you know what, for it actually feels good. And then you run into that one scenario where you're like, but here it doesn't work. And then you have to ask that question, like, right, that one time that it doesn't work, how is that important enough not to do it? And then it's it's an interesting conversation because we have such a range of users, like the range of people that are using the products. It's quite impressive. And so, like, ultimately, we want to make sure that we do good by everybody as opposed to just and that's dangerous, right? Because that could almost be like, oh, we don't want to take the lowest common denominator approach to things. That's definitely not the case. But at the same time, it's making sure that you do no harm.
Yeah, and not everyone who uses this is a photographer, by and large, yes. But, I mean, we as photographers, it's easy to get tunnel vision and think that we got ours and that's what we care about. But, you know, me, I'm also a graphic designer and I use Lightroom to keep track of various designs or elements or textures and so forth. And you know, there are even more features that I may need that are different. So, yeah, like you said, there are countless people and artists using these tools. So, you know, it's hard to pinpoint where something may or may not benefit.
And the other thing is, of course, wanting to avoid only focusing on the super, super complex. Like, we have that problem, the burden of knowledge. Like, you don't know what other people don't know. And a lot of times it's like, oh, it's super easy. What are you talking about? And somebody looks at you like, it's... doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And that person is not dumb. That person is just like, hasn't gone through the same thinking process that you've gone through. And so like, you can't just assume that it makes a lot of sense. And so it's a fun exercise to go through and realize like, oh yeah, it's so easy. What are you talking about? Like, wait, that doesn't make sense. What are you talking about?
Great. Hey, Casper, before we run out of time, you want to give them those questions?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It's actually a good time to start transitioning into that. We have some listener questions from our wonderful Street PX community out there, and we received quite a few, and we'll try to get through at least one of them from each of our submitters because a few dropped a few questions for us. We'll start with a rather heavy one from Anthony Armstrong, and Anthony says, what is Adobe's takeaway for their products after seeing what happened with Apple and their customer frustration with the Mac product line? I think he's referring to
Well, I know what he's referring to. I know what he's referring to. It's referring to like the aperture plus iPhoto equals photos.
Well, I think he is also talking about the whole when the MacBook Pro came out last year, when the pro user backlash and Apple recently noting that they're returning focus to, I think, the pro division.
That one is more of a... I've read things from some of the folks at Apple with some mea culpas about like the heat processing or the problems that they had with the Mac Pro and some of the issues that they had there. And so I think that Apple has definitely heard the news. As it relates to Adobe, I think the closest that we could refer to perhaps would be like Lightroom Desktop, right? So the number one thing that we hear back from our customers all the time is that the performance of Lightroom Desktop isn't up to snuff. It doesn't meet their expectations. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we hear over and over again and really, really loudly and clearly hearing that speed is a big concern to the vast majority of our users. It's interesting. Like, I suffer from it. I shouldn't say that I would suffer. That's not the word I want to use. But I definitely hear it whenever I release a news update on Lightroom Mobile, where people are like, all right, well, great. I'm so glad that you added this thing to Lightroom Mobile. Why don't you make my Lightroom faster?
yep. Or it comes in at you another way. It's like, you know, I'm glad you made it faster, but why didn't you add this feature?
Oh, no. It's never, no. That doesn't ever happen. No. it's every time that I do any kind of announcement, there's like, well, why do you have anybody not working on these things? And there's like a couple of, there's two parts of it, I believe. Like, one is the reality that, you know, there's a law of diminishing returns on engineering a product. And it comes down to communication overhead. Like, when you have the more complex a product gets and the more people you have working on it simultaneously, the less effective each individual is. And they spend more and more of their time just talking to each other than actually building the product. And so there actually is a I don't want to call it optimal because I don't believe in perfection, but there's better versus worse numbers of team members working on a specific product depending on how that product is architected. And the result coming there is that you can't just take the Lightroom Mobile team and say like, all right, you know what, guys, put down Lightroom Mobile, pencils down, don't do that anymore. Now everybody from the Lightroom Mobile Android team, Lightroom Mobile iOS team, and the Lightroom Web team, everybody go work on Lightroom Desktop. That wouldn't work. So that would actually not make it any better. In fact, that might make it a lot worse. So one thing is, it's the age old adage that 9 women cannot have a baby in 1 month. That thing is, it's a truism in some ways. But then the other part of it is like, I think that that frustration comes from the fact that people are saying like, hey, I don't hear you guys talking at all about making my product faster. What I do hear you guys talk about is how you added feature X into Lightroom Mobile, feature Y into Lightroom Android, and feature Z into Lightroom Web. But I'm not hearing you guys talking about how you're making Lightroom Desktop faster. And that's something where I feel like I completely understand, like as a Lightroom user myself, I completely understand that frustration. And I think that the result is that the team has also heard that, and the team is working really hard. And at this point, they're all like, super fixated on what can we do to make the whole thing faster. And so that's something where I would say that's the same or similar kind of thing to like the Apple stuff, where a lot of users were saying, you aren't making me happy. You aren't doing the thing that I wanted to. I didn't ask for this new cheap iPad. I asked for a faster MacBook Pro and you didn't give it to me and you're ignoring me. Same kind of thing. It's like, I didn't ask for Lightroom Mobile. I asked for Lightroom Desktop to be faster. And so I don't want to look at it as a, like, we have to argue with the customer and say like, oh no, 9 women can't have a baby in 1 month. That's not the thing. The argument, I believe, or it's not even an argument. The reality is we hear you. We're working on it. The problem is that it's complicated and it's not, if it were easy, it would have been done already. And that's not an excuse that anybody cares about. The only thing that people care about is like, well, I don't care what you have to do to make it faster. Just make it faster. And that's what the team is doing right now and looking at the how we can make that happen. And, you know, it is an interesting process and it's a good thing, because when you hear people talking that loudly and that strongly, that means that they're passionate. And there's nothing better than passionate users and passionate customers, because they're like, in some ways, like, I just need this. I'm a professional or even like, I'm not a professional and I still feel like I need it, because it's like, it's my way of unwinding. Right, I take pictures as a way of like disconnecting from other parts of my life, and if it sucks, if the product is not fun, then I'm not happy, and I actually like just feel this intense need, and I don't want to be disappointed by this company that I put a lot of faith in, and so please fix this for me, and that's what I hear, and that's what we can say we're working on.
So you hear that, listeners? As Adobe's moving forward, just as Apple is doing, they are listening. It's just we as users, it's probably good to take a step back and be patient sometimes.
Well, you know, and the problem, of course, is like, as a company, we talked about this earlier, you're asking for any kind of sneaks on what we're working on. The thing that you want to avoid is you want to avoid promising, like, it's going to be 5x faster by this date. Because what happens if it's 4x faster? People are like, well, you told me 5x.
And they'll be pissed again.
So it's hard to manage expectations. And at the same time, it's also really hard to judge it. Like, one of the things that's interesting about software development that I found, I'm not a software developer. As I said, I study photography. I'm a horrible coder. But I've been in the business and the industry for long enough to know that every time you're building something, it's kind of like you're building it for the first time. Sure, you may be able to look at something and say like, hey, we built something similar to it. So it's probably going to be like blank or blank. But in reality, you've never done that one thing before. So being able to come back out and say like, oh, it's going to take X number of days to create it and we're going to get Y kind of percentage improvements is impossible, and anybody that tells you that they can do that is lying. So like, the reality is you can get estimates, and some people are better at estimating than other people, but the reality is that it's not easy, and the more complicated the system or complex the system becomes, the more difficult it is. So the reality is, like, the best thing you can do is to say, what's our priority? What's the most important thing to work on? Let's focus on this. Let's understand the needs. Let's understand the compromises, and let's build a system that works as best as possible. I mean, for people that are not familiar with software development, an equivalent is like lens design. You know, you can imagine like you want one of those really amazing lenses. Well, it starts getting really heavy, right? It starts getting really heavy. Mm-hmm. You want a big wide open aperture. It's a lot of glass, and glass is expensive. And so like all these things, that's a compromise that you have to go through and say like, well, do I want to bring something where it's going to be maximum F4 but it's smaller and lighter? Or it's going to be maximum 1.4, or like I'm going to get a Leica Noctilux and just shoot an $11,000 lens. Like, you know, like you have to have that. There's those compromises that you have to realize, and the same thing with software development.
Yeah, see, I always think of it like the old created character in games like Madden. You know, you only have so many statistical points to make your custom player. You know, they can be fast or they can be strong, but they can't be both. So awesome. Many thanks to Anthony out there for that question. And we're going to try and get a couple more in before we let Josh go. So this is one from Pete Roses, which is going to be a bit more personal opinion, I think. Pete says, what kind of reaction do both you and your still photographer colleagues at Adobe have when you read stories about unethical image appropriation, like the recent case of Dada and Mary Ellen Mark? And here I'm not asking about Adobe's official corporate position, but more what you all talk about at the water cooler after hearing these kinds of stories.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the misappropriation of information, of course, is near and dear to our heart as a company that's always been affected by piracy. You can imagine that it's similar. You're like, you spend a lot of time and a lot of effort doing something, and all you're trying to do is you're just trying to put food on the table, you're trying to get your kids through college, you're trying to make sure that you can retire and not be, you know, it's no different than anything else. And some individuals might perceive it as saying, like, well, I don't think it should be that much money, or I think that I don't believe in the company, or whatever the reason is, they go through their own mental calculus of saying, like, well, you're not deserving of that money, so I'm just going to steal this from you. So it's very similar in that perspective of, like, wow, like, some individuals, I did something that I thought was unique and novel and important and people like it, and somebody's decided that they can have it without paying for it. And it's an interesting concept. I mean, there's lots of discussions that have happened over the years. I remember, like, I've worked with a lot of engineering teams in Germany, and in Germany they have a very different take on I don't want to say intellectual property from the perspective of piracy, but intellectual property is a perspective of patents, like software patents. There is a very different perspective of, should software and technology be patentable? And that's getting to the same question. It's like, should this thing that you create, should you charge for it? Should you not charge for it? Does information need to be free, as the piracy party likes to claim? It's a very interesting philosophical conversation that you go into a lot of different directions and you go deep down the rabbit hole.
Well, I think more to Pete's point, he seems to be asking more about how you guys feel when your tools are being used for maybe nefarious actions, such as manipulating an image to falsely represent reality and then using that for self-benefit.
Right. No, I get that as well. And I was just starting off from one side, but then go into the other direction as well, the appropriation of the technology. A bigger conversation, I think, that we have, less conversation related to misrepresenting reality as, like, it, or I should say, what is the impact of that misrepresentation of reality? I think the conversation that happens a lot more often is, like, Photoshop is used, and I would say, like, the biggest damage that Photoshop could potentially be said to have is, like, being used to create a impossible representation of women's bodies. Is more than anything else, that's something where we see that has a huge impact on young women growing up around the world today, and that's something where we talk about that a lot, because the question is, like, what is our responsibility in that regard? Like, is our responsibility to prevent that from happening? How can we even prevent that from happening? What could we do? Do we not create the tools that could be used for different things? Like, who is the person that should be upholding morality? And that's, like, another one of these really deep questions that,
and so
I personally feel really bad when I see, like, the fact that, you know, getting back to my travels, I would be traveling around and I would go to some place and I would see a little girl looking at this picture of an American model, and, like, she's like, she's really dark skinned, like, Southeast Asian girl. And she's like, oh, I should have white skin like this person because this person is really beautiful because of their white skin. And you see the proliferation of, like, whitening products over there. And I'm not saying it's completely because of Hollywood and Photoshop and stuff like that. I know there's a longer historical cultural thing.
No, but it plays a role.
Sure.
We'd be naive to think otherwise.
Sure. But so there's parts of this, like, I see ads in India all the time, by the way, where they have so clearly Photoshopped, where they took a person's picture And on the before, they took that brightness slider and they cranked it to the left and they made the person dark. And then they like took the brightness slider and cranked it to the right and made them bright and said, like, our product will make your skin really fair. And you're like, that product would not do that. That's called Photoshop. It just did that right there. That's not your product. And I can tell. And it was, it's not even because I work in Adobe. Like, anybody could tell. And so it's really sad that, so that's kind of getting into this, using the products to do things that, like, I don't know. I hate the idea of making people feel bad about who they are. You know, that people should feel like happy with who they are and realize that happiness doesn't come in a can. It doesn't come from like this perspective that if only you were whiter or taller or thinner or whatever that like the current thing du jour is to says that you're people are just beautiful as they are. And I had this interesting conversation recently with Lindsay Adler. She's a fashion photographer from New York City. And I interviewed her recently for a new show that I'm doing here at Adobe, where we were talking about this topic and she had her own perspective, which I thought was interesting, which is like one of the things that she loves about models is that models more often than not look different. And that's the reason they became a model. Like normal people aren't like 7 feet tall and 100 pounds. Like, and that's not a normal person. And so that's actually something that's
Slender Man.
Yeah. I'm exaggerating, obviously, but like that was something that was reason why they were really. And so her take on it is like, how do I take what is unique about this individual and accentuate that? And that might not necessarily be the thing that is standard beauty. Like if you look at like when people start to identify what is the standard of beauty, it's actually like they did all those psychological studies where they took people and they just did like statistical averaging of their faces and came up with like a statistically average person. And that was the most beautiful person, right? And that was interesting to think about. Like the thing that was really beautiful about the person was like they were the average, whereas like a lot of these models might be completely not average. You know, that was like accentuating their not averageness, which was interesting and became different because they stood out. And so like she took that same idea and applied it to other models that would otherwise be considered plus size models. Models that otherwise would not be conventionally beautiful, models that might have a lot of freckles, models that have really crazy hair, models that might, you know, have like tattoos or piercings or like all those different things, like identifying what is unique about that individual and accentuate and celebrate the uniqueness of that individual and figuring out like without having to like try and say, all right, well, let's make you and force you into this norm by taking like this liquefied tool and make you something that didn't happen. Like like the liquify tool might be used instead to say like, oh, well, you know, the way she was posing like that way, it caused this strange thing that it's actually not natural. It doesn't look that way. That wasn't actually her body. So how do we make it so that it adheres more towards not the reality that I perceive as opposed to the reality that people would expect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just as an aside, you know, liquify has surely come a long way. I mean, especially with the face awareness that knows where the cheekbones are, the eyelids, mouth, all that. That shit's almost scary when, you know, with the power that we have now.
Well, and to be fair, that's where we had our own learning lesson, where like there was an individual experience that we had where somebody took a picture of a model that was not smiling and made her smile. And it was like read into as like, here comes a white dude telling women to smile. Yep. There we go again. And you know, that's something that's like a good lesson that we need to learn. And it's good for us to hear that. And that's the kind of stuff that we talk around the water cooler a lot and be like, how do we be better about this? How do we be aware and recognize the fact that there are lots of people out there that are like, they're disenfranchised, they're put down, they're put into this weird position and taken advantage of. And how do we make sure that we as a company are not perpetuating it, but at the same time, like getting back to the previous point, like what is our role from a moral perspective as it relates to the tools that we build? And
And that is definitely a rabbit hole. But at the same time, you can't be the creators and the police of your own work. I mean, you said it a while ago, when you're adjusting and creating features, you don't want to focus on the lowest common denominators. Dishonest people will always be there, so you don't want to limit what you're offering simply because these shitheads are doing what they're doing.
Yep. It is hard. It's really, I mean, there's a lot of parallels in a lot of other places, and it's still, I think the good thing is that we talk about this. that's the important thing. We have an open dialogue and keep on considering,
exactly,
figuring out what can we do and what's the right thing.
Yeah, it's not just constant arguing and belittling. You know, there's a discussion to go along with it. Well, not to do a complete 180 here. we want to go ahead and get one more question in from another that had submit. And a big thank you to Pete out there. And hope that we answered or at least maybe opined on that one well enough. Sorry we didn't get to the other two. So, yeah, we have Keith Lane here. And Keith says, with a bit more of a technical question, wow, can't wait and would love it if we could explain why spot removal in Lightroom is so terrible but great in Photoshop. I'm not sure most people pay for the subscription that includes both. Anyway, so there doesn't seem to be a benefit to limit Lightroom's capabilities like that. Would be nice to know to not have to switch between the two programs.
No, that there is actually like some differences between the spot viewing inside of Photoshop and the spot viewing inside of Lightroom. So, and there's a lot of conversations, of course, about that as well. And at the top level, you can imagine that Photoshop is a destructive application. Lightroom is a non-destructive application. Mm-hmm. So that's point one, where they're not the same, and it's hard to make comparisons. Point two.
I always tell my students it's like painting on a piece of glass, and then, you know, you can remove it, and it doesn't affect the picture.
Well, yeah, exactly. But there are technical implications of that, though, in that everything needs to be processable in real time. So, like, as you move a slider, you have to reprocess all the other things that are going on there. And you don't want it to be like, as you try and move that exposure slider, that it's like you move it and then you wait 10 seconds and then the exposure changes and you move it again, you wait 10 seconds because it had to render this whole stuff. So there's a lot of implications about what kind of technologies you can put in there. And this gets back to the point you were talking about, how Moore's Law marches forward, technology gets better, processors get faster. What we can do now is different than what we could do before. But there's one part of it. Another part of it is like Photoshop is very often done on layers. So a lot of things are done on layers. That means that you have access to blending modes and layer masks, which you don't have inside of Lightroom, which means that the approach that a lot of retouchers take is that they will do a lot more to it. It's not just like you press the button and then they're much better. It's like you go into Photoshop, you add a layer, you do some retouching, you add a layer mask, you change the blending mode, you change the opacity, you change the blend. There's a lot of things that are going on in there. And so the capabilities that you have inside of Photoshop, like, we'll never probably be able to match them one-to-one, and maybe we don't even want to.
Your market starts cannibalizing on your other products.
Well, that's not even the issue so much as it is, like, if we start to make those kinds of inroads, that means that we'll erode the capabilities of Lightroom, and so it becomes this, like, two products that neither one of them is really great at the one thing that they want to do. You start to blend and merge everything together. Instead of having two specializing products, you have two generalizing products. And I think a lot of times what we're looking at is the value, as we talked about Lightroom before, is it specializes on photography. And some of the ways of specializing in photography means that we've taken certain compromises. Now, to get to the heart of the question and the request is, make spot healing better in Lightroom.
Yeah. And faster.
What did I tell you about that speed thing? What did I tell you about that? It doesn't matter what you do, people are going to come back and like, it's too slow. And that's fine. And I am the first to say that I'm the same as that. Like, my engineering teams, they love to kid about the fact that I just want everything. I get it. Like, I want it to be faster. I want it to be higher quality. I want to be able to do these things. Like, my goal as a user is to never have to go into Photoshop, because every time I switch back and forth from one application to another, I'm losing time, I'm losing hard disk space, I'm losing momentum, I'm losing, like, all of these things. Like, once I get that, you know, like, get to that what you call a flow state, where you're just editing and go and you edit, you go and you edit, you go, and you're just, like, just burning, right? You're just getting everything done and everything's looking great and just feeling great. And then you go, like, oh, got to go into this other application, I got to wait, and then your momentum is broken. It's like when you're running and you misstep, and it takes forever to get back into that good flow again. So same thing. Get it 100%. I agree. And something that I think it's something we need to work on as well.
Oh, cool. All right, Jim, will you want to toss out the final question to Josh for us?
Well, one of the things that we ask all of our guests.
Are you going to make me rap Llama Llama Red Pajama?
Yeah.
You and I.
No, I'm just kidding.
But yeah, if you can wrap this one, it'd be great. But if there was a place where you could that you've probably maybe never been or maybe you want to go back to photograph, and not only the place, but if there was a time, a specific time period that you would want to do this, where would that be, and when would that?
Oh wow! So. As you started asking the question, something immediately came to mind. And then as you added on to the question, like that threw the first thought out. So I'll just throw out the first thought because there's this one place in Thailand that I really love. And I went there and I took a bunch of photos that all sucked. And in my mind, there is potential there and I just didn't find it yet. And so I'm like, I need to go back again. And I need to hold myself, like I need to be compassionate to myself and realize that just because you go somewhere one time, like the best photographers in the world, they have to go back to the same place over and over again. So I got to recognize that the fact that I didn't do it good the first time doesn't mean that I suck, even though I think that I suck. But it doesn't mean that I suck.
Yeah.
It just means that I need to go back, which is a great excuse to go back. It's a place called Khao Sok in Thailand. It's in the center of Thailand. It's this really beautiful, like, it used to be a valley that was then flooded when they added a dam into it. And so, like, it basically, many people refer to it as Ha Long Bay, which is like in Vietnam, which is like these limestone karst that rise out of the bay.
Oh, but yeah, yeah.
It's so, in Thailand, and there's no tourists there. So it's this amazingly beautiful thing where you don't have trash everywhere. You don't have a thousand screaming tourists every... So Ha Long Bay, beautiful, obnoxious. Khao Sok, beautiful, peaceful. And beautiful. Yeah. Like, did I say beautiful yet? It's beautiful. And so, like, I want to go back there and get a photo that represents, like, the thing that I felt while I was there, which is this amazing tranquility and majesty and splendor and awe and blah, blah, blah. However, when you started asking the question of, like, where would it be, like, at a certain time or a certain place, God, you know, like, that just opens up way too many things, like, in terms of, like, do I have a time machine? Like, what, how far back?
You know, time machine.
How far back can I go? Like, I was like, we're.
Oh, from the inception of the camera. Oh,
yeah. Well, I mean, during the time when you have a kid, the camera.
Okay, yeah. So there's lots of places where I feel like the beauty of the locale. I had this one friend who works at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, and he got really into land cameras and like the photography of the West, and like kind of like there was a bunch of the National Park Service people back in like the 1860s, 1870s who would keep on going west with their land cameras, and the photography that they did when they got into the unspoiled reaches of some of what we have as our really amazing national parks, but sans roads, sans like trains, and sans like power lines, and just there's some kind of like untested majesty about like the western parts of the United States that I would love to go to. I think that would just be amazing and go with like the horse-drawn carts full of the huge like tanks of chemicals and setting things up. But there would just be something like, of course, some of your listeners would be like, you got your dates all wrong, and that's fine, because history was my worst class ever.
Yeah, that's all right. Don't worry about that. It wasn't that region, too. You're an artist.
That's right. Whenever people are like, do this math for me, I'm like, I can't do the math. I'm sorry. No math.
Awesome. Well, cool, man. We really appreciate it. So in order for our listeners to learn more about you and your work and what you may have in store for us in the future, where can we find you online?
Sure. Yeah. So I my portfolio is currently getting a little bit stale, unfortunately, as I've started working again. I poured all of my energy into Adobe and less into my portfolio. So you can check out my now somewhat stale version of my portfolio at my website, which is just joshhaftel.com. But I keep more up to date, like my Insta account, which is also just Josh Haftel. And that's where I keep a lot of my travel stuff on there. And I like to try and keep it fun and keep perspectives of whatever is exciting me today in the world of photography. But both of those they're two completely different content. The joshhaftel.com is very different from my Insta, but both of them are fun. I like keeping them Insta up to date, and I have ideas of how to go back to updating my personal account, but I haven't yet. And it's actually, I've given myself the challenge, like I need to make my own Adobe Portfolio account because it's getting integrated into Lightroom and more, and so it's just easy to get things. Like, they're already inside of Lightroom, already organized. I can just send them over to the Adobe portfolio, which is cool. So I need to probably just do that and basically stop being so lazy.
I got to second that recommendation because the Adobe portfolio system is getting better and better. It's definitely well worth looking at.
I'm inherently lazy and I just need to stop being so damn lazy.
Yeah, we're photographers. Most of us are lazy and yeah. inactive until the deadline is...
Until the deadline hits, yeah. Well,
exactly.
The problem that I have right now is my portfolio, it just doesn't look very good on a phone and I'm a mobile photographer.
the irony of it all.
Give advice, but never take our own.
Yeah, cobbler's kids have no shoes, right?
Well, Jim, where can we find you at?
As always, jimwatkinsphoto.com, and all my links to my social media platforms are on there.
Excellent. And you can find me at recasper.com. That's where I got some blog posts sharing some tips, some tricks, also my upcoming workshops and things like that. But above all, go take a look at Street PX. That's where you're going to find all of our past episodes, which we are rocking and rolling. We're at episode 40 with probably about 2.5 days of published content clocked. If you want to get more content, head over to Patreon. That's where you can contribute to our show, give $1, give $5, what have you. Gives you access to our live feed. So when we record, we do it on Hangout so you can watch us in real time. But you can get bonus content too from the episodes because many of them do run long, and a whole bunch of other rewards as well. So, you know, give a little, get a little. And if you also want some t-shirts, take a look at our merchandise store. Ton of kick-ass t-shirts with some kick-ass cameras, and that's always growing. But just remember, anything that you give to us through these channels goes right back into the show to help us, well, stay afloat. Additionally, reviews help just as much. So if you head over to iTunes or iHeartRadio and throw us some feedback, throw us some stars, that helps us kind of spread the word. So if you don't want to give any financial, you can always give some words. One thing I need to note, this is our last show before our street photo live audience recording. That is going to be one hell of an amazing disaster. So if you're in the San Francisco area, be sure to come down to Street Photo Festival at the Harvey Milk Photo Center on June 9th. Our show starts at 4. Tickets are still available. They're all free. And you can sit in our peanut gallery. And it's going to be just brutally awesome. With that, I think we can go ahead and close it up. Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Yeah, man. We appreciate it, man. It was great.
Yes, and a big thank you to our listeners out there. So go hit up the site, catch up on the show, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right, bye.
Cheers.